the Mexican Congress and founder of the Foundation for Peace and Democracy, Emilio Betances, director of the Latin American Studies Department of Gettysburg College, and many others. That's Our Americas, a special edition, Friday, September 27th, from 3 to 6 p.m., only on WBAI 99.5 FM.
This is WBAI in New York. It's time for Off the Hook. Good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Hook. This is Emmanuel Goldstein with you for the next hour, talking about high technology and the world of hackers. Fiber Optic is here this week.
Yes, I am.
How you doing?
How are you?
I'm pretty good. Pretty good. I just checked out this article in this week's Newsweek. You see this one? How to thwart a national panics attack.
Wow.
Boy. Well, I imagine some people have been hearing about this over the past couple of weeks. We've been too preoccupied with the Bernie S. case to devote the attention that we should devote to this. This week we will be doing that. We'll be speaking with someone from Panics a little later on in the program. But you may have heard about this. The Panics internet site, Panics.com, was the recipient of a massive attack known as a sin flood. Not S-I-N, you fundamentalists out there. S-Y-N. It's a whole different kind of sin. And it's probably worse than the kind that you're always preaching about. Because this kind of sin attack can render the internet completely and utterly useless, helpless, you know, just completely broken. We broke the internet because, I say we, because in 2600 we printed a story that that had to do with a sin flood, but we weren't the only ones. We weren't the only ones. There were other magazines too. Let me read the article from Newsweek and then we'll explain just what exactly is going on and hopefully we'll be able to figure this out. It wasn't one of the much dreaded brownouts on the overloaded information highway. What are the much dreaded brownouts in the information?
I would assume when a router's screwed up and you can't reach somewhere.
Well, you know, it's funny. They call it the information highway now. It's not the superhighway anymore.
Well, they probably realize it's not such a big deal anymore.
I guess so. Maybe it's a different highway. Anyway, nor was it the result of a software glitch or the horrible hair virus. Which, you know, you notice on TV they were saying again that you're going to be hit by this virus. You know, it didn't get you last month, it'll get you this month, and, you know, it didn't get anybody.
You thought Michelangelo was bad.
Yeah, I mean, you know, these viruses aren't really hitting as well as the media hopes they will. So, maybe one day. Maybe we should just make a virus so that, you know, they'll be happy. Because, yeah, for Sweeps Week, that's right,
yeah.
A little present from the hackers. When Public Access Networks Corporation, which is what Panics stands for. Okay, yeah. I thought I got it backwards. A small internet service provider in New York went down for nearly a week. It turned out to be the unwholesome handiwork of a saboteur. The unknown culprit or culprits jammed the system by sending 150 requests a second to the Panics computers seeking to establish a connection. But each request contained a fake internet return address that threw the computers into catatonia. I understand that's outside of Atlanta. Anyway, thanks to Frack and 2600, two publications catering to the computer underground that recently published recipes for this particular type of sabotage, dozens of other places on the net were hit. This was an attack on all of us, says the CEO of one anonymous internet service provider on the West Coast. I don't know why you wouldn't want to be identified, but
Netcom? I don't know. Who could it be?
Could be Netcom. These things always seem to get traced back to Netcom in the end anyway.
Yeah.
He claims that almost all major ISPs have been affected. Those who claim otherwise, he adds, are lying or lucky. Larger systems were only slowed down, so they weren't forced to go public. What does that mean? larger systems will only slow down so they weren't forced to go public. I mean, I know what he's trying to say. He's trying to say that they weren't forced to confess that they were attacked because they were only slowed down, but it's kind of a weird way of saying it. There's no simple defense against the sabotage. The easiest solution would be for all Internet access companies to filter their outgoing traffic to make sure the data have legitimate return addresses. Late last week, the Computer Emergency Response Team at Carnegie Mellon University's Software Engineering Institute issued just that recommendation, but it could take months for companies to take the necessary technical steps. No files have been destroyed, and the attacks so far have caused little more than inconvenience. Still, if companies are slow to respond, large pockets of the Internet could be brought to a standstill. Well, Fiber, is this an exaggeration?
Yes and no. Yes, in the way that they make it sound like it's the end of the world, but no, in the way that people aren't completely defenseless against it, although it is a major problem.
Well, what exactly is it that's going on? What is a sin flood?
Okay, basically a sin flood, a sin attack, a sin storm, whatever you want to call it, is essentially the way a TCP connection gets open. That's the transmission or transport control protocol that runs on top of the Internet protocol. The way that a TCP connection is actually opened is, say, for example, you want to connect to me. I'm a host, okay. And you're somebody out on the net.
Okay.
What you do is that you send me a SYN packet. And a SYN packet is basically a message saying, you know, hi, I'm so-and-so, and I want to connect to you on such-and-such address on such-and-such a port.
So you're synchronizing.
Yeah, that's what SYN stands for, as a matter of fact.
Fine.
And now what I do normally is I accept a connection in my queue, and I say, okay, I'm going to acknowledge the fact that I received your SYN, and I'm going to send you back what's known as a SYN ACK. And
an acknowledgement.
Right, a SYN acknowledgement.
Got it.
And now what you do after you receive the SYN acknowledgement is you simply send an ACK, and then we start talking.
An ACK of your ACK.
An act to my SYNAC.
Okay.
So it's like a three-way handshake.
So I'm acknowledging that you
that
acknowledge
I acknowledge.
Me.
Exactly.
Okay. But you don't acknowledge the fact that I acknowledge that. It stops somewhere.
No, after that point, the connection is open.
Okay.
But then if either end sends a packet to the other, each one of those is act.
Okay. I understand.
Okay. Because the way TCP works, it's meant for full duplex connection, or it's called a connection-oriented connection.
Mm-hmm.
That is, both sides of the connection on the net, the person, the client, and the host, or the server, are sentient of each other while this is actually happening.
Okay, so now, forgetting the weird return addresses that took place in this particular
attack. Well, that's the key. That is the key,
but I just want to, the SYN attack itself, let's just focus on how somebody would do a denial of service using this. It's got something to do with the number of requests in a certain amount of time?
It's not so much the time as it is the number. Like, for example, even somebody with the slowest modem is going to usually be able to do a successful SYN attack. And the way it works, and one of the ways that an administrator can defend against it, is the accept queue for a particular TCP service. Like, let's just say, for example, Telnet, okay? The Telnet daemon, which runs as a service of the Internet daemon, which runs on, let's say, for example, a Unix machine, okay? Going deeper, delving deeper than, like, the actual Telnet service, the Telnet service runs on port 23 on the host or the server, okay? But as far as the actual operating system kernel is concerned, it can only accept 8 simultaneous connections at once.
By simultaneous, you don't mean 8 telnet sessions. You mean at that very second.
At that very moment, it could accept 8 levels deep, 8 connections coming in.
What is that very moment defined as? That very moment is a millisecond? Is it 1 second? What is it?
You could deal in terms of milliseconds, seconds, whatever you want to call it. You could call it jiffies if you want to.
Right, but is it definable by the administrator, or is it just something in the...
No, the time isn't really the issue. The way that an administrator could get around it is simply by increasing the size of that queue. You could make it 100 if you wanted to, and you can get around that problem because a lot of the programs floating around out there only send 8 at a time because they know that the ninth one is going to flood the queue.
Well, let's say you made it 1 million. What would happen? You'd slow down everything if somebody was sin flooding you?
Well, you couldn't set it that high.
Okay.
There is an upper limit that you could set it to.
Well, let's say you could, though. I mean,
okay, in theory, let's say you could set it to a really, really high number, the number of simultaneous connections you could receive. Well, number one, you probably wouldn't have enough memory to do something like that. But let's just say you could. Essentially, what would happen is the person would be sending eight at a time, and you're hoping that there's going to be some break-even point between the number of connections you can accept and the number of connections that he's sending, so that eventually your side is going to time out a lot of those connections early on. So it'll sort of have this cyclical effect, is that the connections that came in earliest on, your machine is going to time those out, and those spaces in the queue will now be available again, while the most recent connection attempts will still be hung, with your machine trying to acknowledge them. That's where your machine actually gets hung. It tries to acknowledge the packets that are coming in, the SYN packets, from an invalid source address.
Okay.
Now, one of the things that, a lot of the attacks in the past have been really simple. They've been, somebody will write a program that it'll just pick an invalid address, and it'll just use that one address. And all somebody has to do, if they notice this is happening, is simply block that one address in their router, and everything's fine. But in the case of Panix's attack, the problem was whatever program was being run randomized through a whole series of invalid source addresses. So it was extremely difficult to block. Now, the problem with the proposed solution in that article that you read is everybody's looking to the service providers to do something about it. And that'll only be of limited success. The problem is going to be, you can't always verify with 100% certainty that a particular source address is valid, because it might be behind a firewall and so on and so forth. So, I mean, that's not 100% of a solution, although it would certainly help.
Well, it sounds also like a way of
passing the buck.
And also kind of making illegal almost any sort of anonymity. You know, if you try to, like,
right,
fake your mail somehow, all of a sudden that won't be allowed. You can't be anonymous. You have to be accountable. And I'm wondering if it might be a smokescreen for something like that.
I wouldn't go that far. I mean, as it stands, I mean, even if they do take steps like that, you'll still be able to forge packets. I mean, you could forge a packet from a real address.
Okay.
And a machine will simply acknowledge that it came from a real address, but the packet is still forged.
Well, that's what happened last year with the Shimomori incident,
right?
Correct?
Yeah, a packet which was forged from a trusted host. Mm-hmm. It was a real host.
Mm-hmm.
And the packet was acknowledged, and the commands therein were executed.
And the real host couldn't acknowledge because it was currently...
Because it was being flooded.
Right.
Yeah.
That was a SYN flood?
It could have been a SYN flood, but more specifically, it was probably just a flood in general that just slowed the machine down, so it couldn't answer.
All right, so basically what this means to people out there that aren't administrators is that when they try to reach a certain machine, in this case it was Panix, it won't be available. They won't be able to use mail if mail is being attacked. They won't be able to use Telnet. They won't be able to use, what else, Finger, any kind
only,
of...
Only coming in.
Right.
To the particular machine. The people that are already on the machine, connecting out and such, they're not going to notice anything.
Right, but getting to that point, I mean, lots of times you're going through a connection, like an R-login connection of some sort, when
right.
you call in.
Right.
So if that particular port is being attacked,
right.
you won't get anywhere. You'll
yeah,
just call
usually,
in and you'll be
right.
stranded.
Usually what happens is a lot of the programs I've seen floating around, they target port 23, which mm-hmm. is a Telnet daemon, port 513, which is the R-login daemon.
Right.
Sometimes port 21, which is the FTP command port, and port 25, send mail,
uh-huh.
and oftentimes port 80, in case there's a web server.
Uh-huh.
And those are the most common ones.
Right, but they could target anything else.
Yeah, they could pick any port they want to.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, I said, if you want to, say, move your Telnet daemon from port 23 to,
yeah.
say, port 800, would that
right.
somehow be effective in combating
that would,
this?
That would help you as the administrator. In fact, I'd recommend to a lot of people to keep a backup Telnet port. If they're an administrator of a system out there, you can modify your inetd.conf file and also your etc services file to simply start another Telnet daemon on a different port that you just made up out of your head that only you know.
Uh-huh.
Or obviously anybody who's on the machine might have read in the file.
Do the remote machines have to be told about this, or just contacting your system, they'll be routed to the proper port?
No, this is more of a countermeasure. So let's say, for example, let me give you a scenario. Say that you're a system administrator and you're currently off site, and you're trying to telnet into your site remotely. You can't get in. it just hangs. You don't know what the problem is, or you get a connection refused.
Mm-hmm.
So what you want to do is you suspect foul play, so you want to try your backup telnet port. So you telnet to this port, say 6789, that you know that you set up a telnet daemon to run on,
mm-hmm.
and only you know about it, or maybe only a couple of other administrators know about it.
People who have scanned your system.
Or people who have done a port scan
right.
might know about it. But, you know, you can take as many countermeasures as you want to, but, you know, you're going to hope that you're going to be able to get in somehow.
Well, what I'm wondering is, supposing you had some sort of a randomization going on that changes your telnet port every couple of seconds, would something like that be conceivable? Because they wouldn't be able to SYN flood the right one consistently. Maybe for a few seconds, and you'd move somewhere else.
Well, that's great if you have some program running on your end remotely that's in sync with the server that's going to be changing it at whatever interval it is.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as in a case like Panix with legitimate users that are expecting a telnet into a well-known service, they're not going to be able to reach that well-known service, telnet or rlogin.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not going to know that they can say telnet with a different port number after the address.
Right. So they would have to know that. They'd have to say the port number.
Right. But again, like you say, I mean, if it's something where, if they're not changing it on a regular basis, it's a relatively trivial task to just do a port scan.
Mm-hmm. And I guess the other question is why? Why would somebody do something like this? And why pick Panix? I guess these are questions to ask when we have someone from Panix on the line.
Yeah.
But it seems kind of strange that somebody would just target one site.
Well, it's not really strange, and you don't really know Panix was the only one targeted.
Mm-hmm.
All you know is that Panix was the most vocal about it. Only a few months ago, another internet service provider in Manhattan was also targeted. And fortunately, it was a relatively simple attack, and I was able to instruct them on how to block the actual SYN flooding in their router. Because it was coming from, they weren't randomizing source addresses, whoever was doing it. So it was relatively easy to stop.
And was it easy to find out where it was coming from?
No, there's no way that you could find out where a SYN flood is coming from. You could tell relativistically how far away it is, but even then you're guessing. By how far away, I mean how many hops away it is, because that is preserved in the packet.
Uh-huh.
But I mean, even if someone's, like for example, Say I work at a particular company, and our internet service provider is UUNET, and yours is also UUNET. We might be only three hops away from each other, and normally the hop count starts at 255 and counts backwards. So we would end up at, say, 255, 254, 253. Say if I saw the hop count was 252, I knew that there's a fairly good chance that we're on the same network and we're probably local.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's still a shot in the dark. You might want to try calling your service provider and see if the people at the network operations center can find this flood of traffic coming from some source and pinpoint it.
Mm-hmm.
But if it's numerous hops away, it's you know, it could be anywhere in the country or anywhere in the world.
So when do you think this is going to end?
It's really hard to say. I mean, there's no real mechanism right now that exists in routers that are commonplace in use on the internet that can detect or stop something like that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the detection part right now really has to be done by a human, an administrator. And stopping it can be relatively easy all the way up to difficult or nearly impossible. In the case of Panix, where the source address is being randomized, the only two things I could imagine you could really do is increase the size of the accept queue much higher than 8 simultaneous incoming connections. And the other thing is, if you can notice some kind of pattern, then you might block an entire class of addresses, at least until the person gets bored and goes away.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for example, if you notice that the floods are always coming from fake addresses at universities.
Right.
Or they always begin with 128. I mean, you can block all addresses from 128, but then again, you know, you might block a legitimate customer. So it gets really difficult if you're running a public access site.
Now, do you think it's something that we should keep quiet as far as being specific as to how it works? Like, should we have printed that article? Should Frack have printed that article?
No, I don't think being quiet about it is going to contribute to it being fixed. Certainly not. I think that as many people about it as possible should be informed. The only way you're really going to have a solution is if you put enough of a scare in the router manufacturers to come up with some kind of scheme or mechanism that could detect and control that kind of attack. It's always been possible. That kind of attack has been present in the Internet Protocol since it came about in the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that it's only becoming commonplace now doesn't really surprise me. It's sort of like eventually the deep, dark secrets of the Internet Protocol trickle down to the masses or the miscreants that hang out on IRC.
Yes, and we know what happens when they get a hold of it.
Yep.
All right, well, that's an interesting topic, something that I think it will be seeing a lot more of in the future, hopefully some solutions. We're supposed to hear from Alexis over at Panix within the next 10 minutes or so, but I guess we can take phone calls in the interim. 212-279-3400 is our telephone number. Anything else interesting happen to you in the world of communications or computers this past week or couple of weeks?
Well, one thing I could say without going into too many details is there is definitely a change in attitude that I'm seeing firsthand amongst various corporations in approaching hackers from hackers that have a good security background.
In the last week? You've seen it firsthand.
Yeah, it's a snowballing effect.
Okay.
That I think is.
So what this changing attitude means? What that they're accepting us for what we are, or more afraid of us than ever? What?
No, I think obviously you're always going to have corporations that are afraid, but I think that more and more corporations are turning on to the fact that hackers are a valuable resource to improving computer security. And that they can no longer rely upon all the computer security people running around, which I know we've pointed out lots of times in the past. A lot of them are just like the antivirus software authors that are promising the world and aren't really dealing with the facts.
So these computer security people must not be too happy about that change in attitude.
No, unless these computer security people happen to be working with the hackers firsthand, which some are.
That's good. Wow. I've noticed a couple of things phone-wise. You know, 9X, I don't want to be, too generous here, but I have to say 9X seems to be getting better a little bit. Not a lot. You know, all the phones are still broken. They don't work, but apart from that, they seem to be, fixing things a little bit more.
Really?
For instance, our ISDN now works. It works perfectly.
Oh, that's right.
On 56K, which it never did before. All of a sudden, it just works. It's like, they listened. It took them a year to do something, but they listened. The payphone I wanted to fix, they fixed. It was only one payphone, but they fixed it. It took about 14 calls, but they listened. I think it's just a question of who is stronger, the consumer or the corporation. And I think if the consumer is willing to really become a pain in the ass about it and make lots of phone calls, it'll eventually get done. I'm just starting to wonder if there is a cause and effect. I think there might be, but. It's still, very hard to get things done. I got this huge rebate. Actually, I got several huge rebates on my phone bills. Some sort of rebate over a year and a half for missed appointments. Now, they're always missing appointments. They're always saying they're going to be there between the hours of 9 and 5, Monday through Friday, whatever. They try to narrow it down as much as possible. Then they don't show up, and you call and complain about that. Well, apparently something happened, and they had to refund all this money for a year and a half. I was getting rebates of $150.
Wow.
Yeah, that's a lot of missed appointments. So,
too bad it wasn't Domino's Pizza.
No, actually, I wouldn't want a rebate from them. But I just think, they're being held accountable. And I think that's a good thing when you hold someone accountable for their mistakes or inappropriate actions.
Well, it's probably the FCC or the Public Service Commission that held them accountable.
Yeah, and we hold them accountable. They won't do anything unless we're constantly pestering them. So I just think that... we've seen over the last couple of weeks a lot of public pressure on various issues, and we've seen it work. So what I'm trying to say is that I think it does work. It doesn't feel like it works, but over time, I think it does. Something I noticed yesterday? I was heading down to Philadelphia, and I had to make a phone call there. And, all the 950s seem to be blocked now. That's a bad thing that 9X has done. For some reason, there are all these payphones uptown, all begin with the 223 exchange, right, somewhere in Midtown. You can't dial 950 from there. You get a recording saying your call can't be completed as dialed. I don't know if that's a new thing or if it was always like that. But I had to make a regular phone call. You know, I couldn't use a calling card because I didn't have one on me. You know,
right.
I didn't have a calling card. I hadn't mugged any old ladies lately. I didn't, you know, I didn't have any means of making a phone call, and I left all my calling cards at home. So I had to actually dial OnePlus and see how much it costs. And I was in New Jersey, right? I was calling down to Philadelphia in New Jersey. It cost $2.95.
Wow.
Just to connect.
To connect.
Yeah.
And then it's like, I know within the city, it's like 25 cents for 2 minutes now.
Yeah, but that's 25 cents. All right, that's bad, but, you know, I can deal with that. But $2, how can a phone call? I mean, AT&T announces today that they're going to charge 15 cents a minute, 24 hours a day for residential customers, you know, to make their lives easier. You know, you don't have to worry about nighttime discounts and, you know, 10 cents a minute to God knows where, you know, and all that kind of thing. 15 cents a minute all the time. You know, nice and simple. So how come a payphone costs $2.95 just to make the connection? I don't get it. You know, and no one can seem to explain that to me. No wonder people are using red boxes. It's the only way to make a phone call. No one in their right mind would put $3 worth of quarters into a payphone just to connect. And you know what else they do? When you connect and you talk to somebody for, I guess it's like 3 minutes. I think that's what you get, 3 minutes. You used to get, you know, all the money would go into the hopper.
Right.
And that would be your warning that, yeah, you know, you're now in overtime.
Yeah.
You know, your sudden death overtime, you're going to get some sort of a warning at some point, and operators will be calling you and chasing you and things like that. Well, that doesn't happen anymore. Now you get a recording. That all the money goes in, and you instantly get a recording demanding money. And you don't get reconnected to your party. You don't get the chance to say goodbye. You don't
oh,
get
really?
Any more. Even a CoCod gives you more warning than that.
Wow.
It's just all the money goes down, and it says 50 cents, please, you know, some arbitrary figure. For the next 10 seconds, 50 cents, you know, whatever. And you have to come up with the money there, or you don't talk to your friend anymore. What happened to me, this is kind of funny, the operator comes on after a while, the AT&T operator comes on and says, you know, where's the money? And I was very upset at this point. I said, you cut me off with absolutely no warning. You know, I mean, that's not very nice. And she said, oh, no, we didn't cut you off. Your party is still there. You just can't hear him. So I said, well, could you just reconnect me for a second so I could say goodbye? And she did, you know.
Yeah.
I was able to say goodbye. But, I mean, I don't know what he was hearing during that whole time. You know, if he was hearing me talking and cussing into the phone because I couldn't hear him, it's a bizarre way of doing business, you know. Just sort of a ransom. You know, you have to pay right now or that's it. You're not going to hear from your friend anymore. $2.95. I mean, where do they come up with figures like this?
I don't know.
So, yeah, that's something I think we should hold long-distance companies accountable for. You know, if you're local, yeah, it's a quarter. And if you're across a state line, it's $2.95. It doesn't make any sense.
Well, soon, I figure it's probably going to be a quarter for a minute or something. It used to be a quarter for 5 minutes.
That's 10 cents for up in Massachusetts, you know.
Oh, really?
10 cents at a payphone still.
Yeah.
Now, I don't understand.
Yeah, where,
I mean, I know
the
they
forest?
Have a lower quality of life up there, but it's not 150% lower.
Yeah.
You know, I don't understand why they get such a big discount. So
yeah.
I'll be pushing to get them increased.
Hmm.
No, actually, I just want them to account for their prices.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of insane. All right, 212-279-3400 is our telephone number. If you have anything to contribute as far as telephones or the internet or hacking or whatnot, give us a call. 212-279-3400. Good evening. You're on Off the Hook.
Yes, Emmanuel. Hi, I have something to contribute on telephones.
Wait a minute. That is the voice, if I'm not mistaken, of Rebel, but I just saw Rebel in the studio. So how is it that you're on the phone, too?
Well, it's my magical touch here. Anyway.
I can't escape this guy. Okay, yeah, go ahead.
Did you know that when you dial 10-6980 from most areas in Queens and Manhattan, you get not 9X operator, AT&T?
You do. Okay, you get AT&T. Let's hear this out, all right?
Let's try this out.
See, people putting guns to their heads. No, let's like, you know, let this play out for a second.
Well, before you pull the trigger.
Yeah, 10-6980 and zero, you will get AT&T.
That's right.
Okay. Why would we care? Why would we care? Yeah, why?
Because actually, it was happening in Queens, and I thought that it was only happening in my exchange, because it didn't happen in another part of Queens.
Uh-huh.
So I told the phone company this, and of course it never got fixed. And then I recently discovered that it's happening in Manhattan.
You don't say.
Yeah, try
okay.
it. One
well, all right, but let's say it works. Is there any significance to this other than the fact that...
No. Well, there is, because let's say that... Well, first of all, 10-6980, you're supposed to get 9X. that's the point of that.
Well, 698 spells NYT, New York,
right.
California.
Yeah.
That would be
but
90.
Second of all, the reason why I discovered it is because I was on a cold cut and I had to dial a 9X operator because it did, when I dialed 0, it connected me with a strange long distance company. So I dialed 106980 and I got AT&T.
Okay. Is there any advantage to this or disadvantage to this?
Not really, but the other thing is that if you dial 10216 0, the area code and number,
uh-huh,
which would be 0, a local area code and number from any payphone, it'll put the call through for free, believe it or not. And this sometimes works, this sometimes doesn't work.
And you try this from payphones.
Right.
All right.
Well, we're probably fairly certain that now it definitely doesn't work anymore because millions of people are trying it right now.
Yeah, you're probably getting all circuits busy recording if you try now, but try later and it might just go through.
Well, dial the 6980 thing.
No, I believe I've heard you talking about this for a number of, well, it seems like forever actually, but
yeah,
it's been a while. And I remember you saying at one point that that you were able to actually get the network to ask you for money from your house.
Right.
Now,
that's the other thing.
How did you do that?
Well, it wasn't from my house. What happened was is that as I told them, the person in the what's known as the I guess MAC center, which is the, I guess Fiber, you can explain what a MAC center is.
MAC is in MAC.
Right. I think it's a control center.
It's a major account center.
Okay. Okay. I was referred there.
Well, you are a major account.
I seem to be. They told me, okay, we'll fix it. They fixed it for a while, but then it sort of malfunctioned, and now, and when you dialed that way, it connected you with coin operator. And the other thing is that if you dial from any, most of the payphones uptown, actually a lot of payphones in Manhattan, 10, like 222 or 333, like 10, any other carrier access code but AT&T, plus I think it's either 1, the long distance area code and number, or 0, the long distance area code and number, you will get coin operator.
Okay, and where is coin operator?
That's
located?
What I want to know. I said, what company is this? And they said, well, we represent a lot of companies. I want to see if they, I mean, I'm sure you could red box with this company.
Interesting. You only get this from payphones, or can you get this from any phone?
You can only get this from payphones, unfortunately. And believe it or not, it works on a cold cut.
Well, okay. A code cut that allows carrier access codes.
Right.
All right. Well, you know what? We're gonna try your 10698 from
here.
I'll
be updating this on my webpage. If anyone wants to see these updates, please.
Do you have a webpage? What could that address be?
It would be www.escape.com. That's ESCAPE.com/tildeRebel, REBEL. And if anyone wants to send me email, they can email rebel@escape.com.
Okay. All right, fine. Great. Now, we're going to check that out. Thanks very much for the input there. Fiber, you have any
comment on that? Just a little comment that if 106980 doesn't get you anywhere, you'd probably have better luck reaching 9X by calling their 800 number, that new 54-9X.
54-9X, whatever that's all about.
Yeah.
But let's see if we can actually get a dial tone. That would be nice. I guess we can't do that there. There's one. Okay. Now we're going to... 10698 and then 0. See what kind of operator we get. If we get any operator whatsoever.
AT&T. To place a call, please dial the number that you are calling.
Well,
request,
that
say...
sounds like AT&T to me.
Yeah, it does.
So why is AT&T showing up on 10698?
I don't know, but I'd be suspicious because obviously you're supposed to be able to use 10698 to call 201 area code,
uh-huh,
Northern Jersey.
Well, do you think 9X has signed some sort of an agreement with AT&T to handle... 9X is going to be going into the long-distance market pretty soon.
Right.
So I don't know why they would give away their carrier access code to AT&T.
I don't know, but that would be weird because that would kind of violate the LATA boundaries. And, you know, you don't want to do that because then the chaos and mayhem would ensue.
Right. Well, I think there's only one thing we can do, and that is... Confuse the operator. Yeah, we're going to have to ask the operator what this means when we call a carrier access code and get them. They're not supposed to be there. So why are we getting them? Let us connect one more time to 106980, and we will ask just what's going on. First, we have to get it out to him, though. There we go. Oh, Okay, in a moment we will... Oh, that sounded weird. We will have AT&T on the line.
AT&T. To place a call, please dial the number that you are calling. For other requests, please say information, credit, or operator.
What if you don't say any of that?
What if
por
you say
favor, espere.
Okay. I don't know.
Por favor, marque el código del área y el número al cual está llamando. Para llamadas internacionales, marque 01, el código del país, de la ciudad, y el número local. O marque el 0 ahora para la operadora.
Please, please help, help. Well, we just need help, that's all.
Por favor, marque el número al cual desea llamar. U oprima el 0 para hablar con la operadora ahora.
I don't know what's going on at this point.
Dial zero.
Dial zero? Okay.
Favor, espere la asistencia de la operadora.
They're as butt-headed in that language as they are in English.
Buenas noches. AT&T Español, habla René.
Yes, do you speak English?
Yes.
Hi, I dialed 10698. Am I supposed to get AT&T when I dial that carrier access code?
10698?
Yes.
No. Did you say anything?
I might have said something, but I don't think I said anything. I just went into the Spanish part by accident.
Okay, yeah, see, the machine picked up on an accent or something and just transferred you over to Spanish.
Wow, that doesn't sound like a Spanish accent you have. what part of the country am I in?
Texas.
Ah, Texas, okay. Well, I don't want to run up the bill, but I'm just curious if why 10698, which used to get me 9X, now gets me AT&T, if there's some sort of a deal going on there.
No. You want to hang up and try again?
Maybe I'll do that. Maybe it'll work different if I try that. Thank you very much.
Uh-huh. Bye.
All right. That always seems to be the answer that they give. Hang up and try again. All right. Well, we confuse them. I think we have Alexis from Panix on the line, do we?
Yes, you do.
I don't know how that happened, how we got you on the line just now, but we did it, and... Well, we were just talking about the whole Panix thing a little while ago, and can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you just fine. We got fiber optic here.
Excellent. Hi, Mark.
Hi, how are you?
I guess basically right now we'd like to find out what's going on with you guys. We talked about the attack, the theory behind the attack a little bit, but have you guys survived?
Yeah, we have. It was touch and go for the first couple of days. We sort of got lucky. There was a routing glitch inside of Sprint that we had nothing to do with that Sprint fixed, but... For its duration, which was about 8 hours, we were immune to the attack simply because packets are getting lost out in the ether. So that helped us out. And then on Sunday, I was able to do a little kernel hack to discard all of the attacker's packets because the attacker carelessly left the same TCP sequence number on every packet. So that was an easy hack I could do to get rid of them. There was another day, part of Monday, where we were attacked fairly badly, and... there was not much we could do about it at that point. But later, late that night, I did a more significant kernel hack that was able to protect us and has continued to protect us until now. But the bad thing is that this hack is not really a true solution. It's a combination of lack of clue on the part of the attacker and lack of bandwidth and a bunch of other things. Any determined and clever attacker could still take us down or take anybody else down in the entire net, for that matter.
Well, what kind of response have you gotten since making this public?
From who are you asking?
From computer security people, from media?
Well, let's see. I mean, just bit by bit, let's see. First of all, the customers, the ones who we've heard them have been extraordinarily supportive, which is really nice. But you have to assume that there's going to be that silent group that just says, oh, the hell with this. You know, we don't need this. We'll go somewhere else. Not really understanding that it could easily follow them no matter where they go. Then there is the computer security groups, the various people who are professionally interested in this. They've been very interested in it. We've had high-level conference calls with numerous people about this. Pretty much the entire industry where the industry is involved with this is now working on various solutions. We've got a couple of notions, one of which we think is going to be a pretty good guard against this. The problem is that it's only going to be useful on some machines, mostly the more heavily supported Unix systems, like from Suns or HPs or IBMs, that sort of thing, or Digitals, you know, whatever. It's really not going to help people with less popular boxes. It'll also take a long time, I think, for it to migrate down into the public domain systems like Linux. and NetBSD, although actually my understanding is that work's not underway on them too. So, I mean, I think that in the next month you'll see a lot of Unixes become immune or almost immune to this kind of attack, but you're going to see all these special purpose boxes that are very important to the functioning of the Internet as a whole, the routers, the terminal servers, the special purpose dial-up boxes. They'll all stay subject to this sort of attack, and there won't be any quick and ready fix for it. So that's a great concern. The only long-term solution to this problem, I think, is going to be to to have all the service providers out there cooperate and prevent this attack at its source. It's a kind of a funny situation where if I'm a service provider and my customer is attacking you, I can protect you, but you can't protect yourself. And if you have a customer who's attacking me, you can protect me, but I can't. So everybody has to cooperate, and if they do, they'll be able to protect each other very well. But if even only a few people don't cooperate, the entire net stays open to attack.
And are you even able to tell what people are not cooperating, or you just know that somebody out there isn't cooperating?
Well, at the point where we get people cooperating, it will be easier to trace the attacks back. I mean, we know how to trace the attack back. It's just a very difficult project because it involves a lot of work on the part of every organization through which an attacking packet travels. And a packet getting to me from the attacker could travel through, you know, six different organizations. It could go to Sprint and to ANS and to UUNET and to BBN before it gets to us. And doing so and doing it while the attack is still underway, that's difficult, especially if the attacks are short-lived. There are possibly one or two other techniques that we have thought of that might actually help us catch the attacker, which are a lot trickier and which I don't really want to go into on the air. But in general, yes, it will be possible to trace them, and the more that the providers take this seriously, which will be evident, it will be evident that they do when they actually start cooperating in this way, then the easier it will be to trace the attacks back quickly and deal with them. I think that we've gotten a lot of attention in the last couple of weeks. I mean, certainly I haven't enjoyed plastering our names all over the national media attachment with this incident, but if it accomplishes our goal of making all the providers really aware of this as a major problem, then it will have been worth it.
Do you think there's other sites out there that are being attacked?
I know for a fact that there are many other sites being attacked. It's amazing to me that, you know, when we first went public with this, nobody had really talked about it out loud. When we talked to CERT, they said, oh, yeah, well, we've heard about maybe a couple dozen trickle attacks, but this is the first flood. But since we went public with this, I've gotten private calls and mail from people. Dozens of sites have been attacked before we were, who had not spoken to anybody at all. And since then, there have been even more. One of them called us and said, help, what do we do? And I said, well, look, here's what I know how to do so far. Here are the other things that you'll be able to do soon if, you know, when your Unix vendor provides the support. And in the meantime, do the right thing and go public. And they did. And, you know, the more that happens, the more people become aware. In that case, it was the Internet Chess Server folks, Dan Slayer and his crowd. And I just wish that more people would admit it when they got hit, because it would provide everybody else with more awareness of the problem and, you know, perhaps quicker response to it.
Yeah, I mean, that's one thing I've always said about panics, is that you're extremely accountable. If you have a power flicker, there's a message of the day about it 10 minutes later.
Yeah, we try. I mean, it really aggravates me that for the second time in 3 or 4 years, we're at the forefront of a major, major Internet attack, and we're there only by default because nobody else is willing to talk about it. But, it's what we got to do. We got to talk about it. We can't just keep it quiet because, you know, we have sort of conspiracy of silence by default. And if nobody spoke up, the Internet would have crumbled halfway, you know, to nothing before anybody even noticed that we were having such a major problem.
What has the customer response been so far?
Well, I mean, as I said, the customers who we've heard from have been really wonderfully supportive. I don't get very gushy as a rule, but, I mean, it really made a difference, you know, spending, you know, a week straight getting almost no sleep working on this problem and trying to solve it and having such an incredibly difficult time. Having, you know, such really good support from our customers made a big difference. But, you know, also, as I said, for every one of those, there's got to be a customer or two or five or ten who just said, geez, the heck with this. You know, why do we need to stay with this site that's having problems? Many of them may not, you know, have paid attention or are not technically savvy enough to properly judge the accuracy of our words and just may think that, you know, we're just being incompetent. So, you know, who knows how much that's cost us?
Uh-huh.
It can't be good. I know that 3 years from now, we're still going to be hearing about this from people who don't really know the whole story and will just come, oh yeah, isn't it panicked? Aren't you those guys that had that big service problem 3 years ago? And, you know, trying to explain to them what happened is going to be a complete waste of time.
Uh-huh. Has the media, for the most part, gotten the story right?
Compared to a lot of mangling of story that I've seen in the past, I would say the media did very well on this. Of course, we tried very, very, very hard to get things right. I would say that mostly they did okay, especially considering that, you know, it's not, you know, there were a New York Times or Wall Street Journal writer's responsibility to write down all the technical details. It's, you know, nobody wants to read that in the papers. The one thing that disturbed me was that a lot of the reporters, especially the early ones, they all loved the same phrase, brought to its knees. And they all said, we were brought to our knees for 5 days, which is completely bogus. I mean, we were various different services. If you combine all of their downtime together, we're down for about 36 hours over the space of 5 days. And we weren't almost put out of business. I think that phrase came from, you know, our original message of the day, which said that, you know, if an attack like this went on for a week, we could be out of business. It's not the way it happened, and we did figure out several defenses to it, one of which so far is holding 2 weeks later. And by the way, we are still getting attacked every day.
What kind of person do you think is behind this?
It's not really clear, although we have some... by the way, before I go on, I'd like to point out one writer who I thought an especially extraordinarily good task. That was Elizabeth Corcoran of the Washington Post. She used to be a panic shooter before she moved, and we just thought that her story was so dead on, it was amazing. Which is not to say that the other writers didn't do a good job, but that was one of the earlier articles, and it really got everything just very well.
Uh-huh.
In any event, to answer your question, while there's obviously no way for us to be sure, there is one good lead that we have, which is that in the first week of attacks, of all of the machines that we have at our site, we have a web machine which is for use for Panax itself and for Panax's individual customers who have, you know, home pages on us that they get there for free. And then we have close to 1,000 corporate sites that, customers that keep their entire site online on machines at our office. And of all of the customers who use that type of service, only one of them was attacked the same way that our own site was attacked. And that was a customer who gets all their service for free, the Voters Telecom Watch. My guess is that for those who aren't aware, Voters Telecom Watch is an organization which has been remarkably effective in focusing net support for the fight against the so-called Communications Decency Act, which is an outrageous and obviously unconstitutional piece of legislation, about which I think more has been said in the past and probably be said in the future, so I won't go into that here. But they've been wonderful in fighting against that and also in fighting to eliminate the really unreasonable restrictions on export of cryptography, which, of course, already exists everywhere else in the world already. So they've done a lot of really good stuff, but they've made a lot of enemies on the right wing and in the religious right. Whether or not one of their enemies was behind the attack is only a matter of supposition, and whether or not that enemy is part of the religious right is also just a guess. It's not a guess I have a lot of confidence in, but it's the best theory I can come up with. Because, as I said, of close to 1,000 corporate sites here, only VTWs was attacked.
Were the packets similar in structure?
The packets were guaranteed identical in structure to the ones that came from us because they were coming in at exactly the same time from the same forged address with the same forged sequence number.
So
it's very clear that the VTW attack and our attack were exact, in fact, not only from the same person, but were being generated by the same program at the same instant.
Now, do you see just one attack happening a lot, or do you see different attacks?
It's very clear that there are many different people running different types of code. For example, while this I'm far from certain about, it seems likely, given the pattern of attack and the types and the contents of the packets involved, that the attacks we're facing now and which we've been undergoing for the last week are not, in fact, from the same person as originally attacked us. But again, that's not something I'm by any means confident about. It's just a guess.
Uh-huh.
And I know that certainly that there are many other sites out there being attacked. They're seeing different types of patterns, different types of packet content. We've seen a couple of really stupid attacks where all the attacks have the same bogus source IP address, which you know, when there's no such machine out there, works almost as well. But, of course, if they all have the same forged source address, you can just filter off everything from that source address, and it's not a problem. So, you know, the attacks have varied in cleverness and capability. You also see different volumes of packets from different types of attackers. You know, some people are obviously dialing in from a slow modem connection. Others have a 56K or an ISDN.
Interesting. Do you think that that publicizing this in 2600 and in FRAC has made the problem worse or brought something...
Well, it's clearly brought the problem about and made it much, much, much worse than it was before. You'd never heard of these attacks before 2600 and FRAC published. On the other hand, it would have happened sooner or later. And, you know, had you not published the article or had FRAC not published the article, the authors might well and probably almost certainly would have posted their code on the net anyway. So, you know, while I really, really wish it hadn't come out, I don't particularly bear a grudge against you or FRAC about it because it would have happened sooner or later.
I'm just wondering if this kind of thing had been publicized, say, 3 or 4 years ago, do you think we'd be in better shape now? Barbara, you're nodding your head vigorously.
Well, clearly we'd be in better shape now. It's not completely clear to me what would have happened. You know, one possible interpretation or scenario, I guess, is that, you know, in the old days, there were a lot more clueful people as the providers that were there. Because the total amount of clue on the Internet has not grown or has grown slowly. But the total number of providers, even large providers, has mushroomed dramatically. And what that means is that while all the big providers still have really smart people working for them, there aren't very many of them, and they're very, very hard to find. When we talk to the folks at you know, certain large providers who are trying to trace the packets back through, even in the cases where they were very helpful and willing to help, most of the time we had to teach them what to do with their own equipment in order to help trace.
Barbara, does that resemble your experience? The amount of clue on the net is going down.
I'm not exactly.
I didn't say it was going down.
Not really shocked.
I said it was going up very slowly.
Okay.
But the number of total number of providers and people working in the business has grown so dramatically that the clue per person on average has diminished.
Right. The percentage of clue is I guess, not rising the way the number of users is.
The clue per capita.
Or the number of providers, which is really the point.
Right.
You can make up all sorts of funny acronyms and definitions of you know, defining clue per square kilometer or clue per person or clue per provider. But I think the point is that it's harder to find good people quickly who can help detect the intruder and trace them back, or detect the attacker and trace them back or her back. And that makes it easier for them to get away with it these days. On the other hand, you know, everybody has more bandwidth. If we'd been attacked in the days when we only had a 56, it would have been a serious problem for us, not only because it was damaging our machine's ability to function, but also because there was so much data coming in the attack that it would have severely constrained our ability to do other stuff as well at the same time. And it's very different, you know, when the difference between, say, a provider with a T3 and a provider with a 56K. As time goes on, the capacity of your equipment grows, and but, you know, then again, so does the capacity of your attacker. You know, maybe if it happened 3 or 4 years ago, most attackers would have been coming in over 2400 BPS modems. Also, you know, another aspect to that question is, you know, 3 or 4 years ago, there weren't a lot of people out there with you know, Linux or NetBSD boxes or FreeBSD boxes who could easily execute this sort of attack. Having Unix boxes is a much trickier and more interesting proposition a few years ago, and actually knowing enough to modify the kernels used to allow you to forge source addresses was, you know, even rarer.
Have the authorities taken an interest in this?
Yeah, but they, you know, they're counting on the people who are affected by this to really track down the bad guys. I guess that, you know, if we put the finger on somebody, they'll come and take them in handcuffs, but they're not going to chase them themselves.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it's sort of unfortunate. It's the only business I know of like that. I mean, if you knocked over a bank, the FBI wouldn't tell the bank, well, when your bank tellers go and identify the guy, then we'll go and get him with handcuffs. No, they go and try and figure it out themselves. But realistically, there's no other option here, really. They don't have enough good people. I mean, there aren't enough good people to run the net there, almost. So much less, you know, if half of them were off doing law enforcement.
It's quite a story, and it's unfortunate that you have to be the focal point of it, but I think...
Yeah, well, it is, but...
Yeah, as far as an enlightened approach, though, I think you've definitely got that. I mean, imagine this happening to another. I don't want to give, you know, the names of the big companies, but you know who they are. If it happens to them, they're just going to deny it, and they're going to try to blame somebody else. So it probably is already happening to them. Do you think that's...
We know for a fact that it is. I mean, we know that it, I mean, much as I don't like it, I don't feel it's my place to deny somebody else anonymity, especially if they've told me about it in confidence.
Uh-huh.
But for a fact that numerous providers have been attacked, including at least two in the New York area.
Well, there's the Newsweek article quotes an anonymous internet service provider on the West Coast. You have to wonder, you know, why someone wants to stay anonymous for something like this. You know, they...
I'll tell you why. Because when you go public, you suffer for it. Our business will suffer because we're talking about this. There's no question about it. We saw it happen 3 years ago with the sniffer attacks. And again, we publicized something that nobody on the net knew about, and that half the people weren't willing to admit even once we had announced it. If we hadn't done it, you know, probably the large majority of hosts on the internet right today would be compromised and owned by intruders.
Mm-hmm.
As it is, everybody understands that the sniffing attack is now and mostly is protected, mostly because they're doing the sort of stuff that we actually wrote about in our advisory when this first happened.
Right.
But despite that, and despite the fact that we did the work and figured out the problem and let everybody know about it, we're still paying the price talking about it. People still, you know, reporters come to me 3 years, 3.5 years later and say, oh, Panix, isn't that the site that had this big security hole?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I just smack my forehead and try and ignore it because there's nothing you can say.
Well, Alexis, it's like, you know, not only are you an internet service provider, but it seems like you're actually participating in the building of what the net will eventually become.
We're trying really hard. I mean, I have to say that you know, we cannot take the majority of credit here, and I'm really glad to be working with such a really good bunch of people. There are a lot of people all around the net who are working with us on this and who are doing significant work, maybe more work than we're doing in terms of actually solving the problem. The biggest solution, the hardest, of course, is, as I said, having every provider prevent their customers from doing forging. But in the meantime, all the major Unix vendors out there are working very hard on making it easier for their machines and their operating systems to withstand these sorts of attacks. There are a lot of other people scattered about who are just highly expert in this sort of stuff, giving us a lot of help. I think I should especially mention Avi Friedman from NetAxis, which is a very Panax-like company in Philadelphia. Was extremely helpful in this. He actually recognized the exact nature of the attack. I was on the phone with him when I first spotted it. He recognized it first because he'd actually heard about something like it in Philadelphia very recently before then. He worked with me on fixing it. He came up with one of the notions that we implemented to improve the code.
Right, Alexis, I'm sorry, I hate to cut you off, but we're down to our last minute. I just wanted to give folks the opportunity to get a hold of you and to find out more about Panax. Can you give us that information?
Well, yeah. You can send mail to info@panax.com to get general info about the system. You can send email to staff@panax.com if you want to ask specific questions.
That's PANIX.
That's right. And staff is a CAFF. I would ask people not to send us a lot of mail asking us for details of this attack, mostly because you can find most of what we're going to talk about on our webpage, just www.panax.com. There actually isn't a lot of detail up there right now, but there'll be a lot more, which is just going to be basically reprints of our messages of the day over the last 2 weeks. That'll be up there in the next day or two.
And is there a phone number that new users can contact you at?
Me directly? Probably not. I'm still trying to catch up on the last 2 weeks.
Or just Panax in general.
Panax's phone number in general, 212-741-4400.
Okay. Alexis, thank you very much for being with us today, and best of luck in combating this.
Thanks.
All right. Alexis Rosen, founder, president, runner of Panax.com, under attack by all kinds of evil programs out there. Hopefully we'll figure out a solution. All right, that's our show for tonight. Thanks, everybody, for calling in. Sorry we didn't get to as many phone calls as we would have liked to have. We'll be back again next week. We'll try to make up for that. Emmanuel Goldstein for Off the Hook. Good night.
The telephone keeps ringing, so I ripped it off the wall. I cut myself while shaving, now I can't make a call. Couldn't get much worse.
October 12th. Some people call it Columbus Day. Others, the Day of Indigenous Peoples. It's also known as El Día de la Raza. October 12, 1996, marks the 504th anniversary of the initial clash between European powers and the indigenous inhabitants of what is now called America. October 12, 1996, also is the date for the Great March on Washington for Latino, Immigrant, and Poor People's Rights, organized by Coordinadora 96. Join Coordinadora 96 for this historic march on Washington, called in response to anti-immigrant policies coming out of Washington and state houses throughout the country. If you want to volunteer in organizing or want bus information, call Coordinadora 96 at 212-505-0001. That's 212-505-0001. And mark the date on your calendar, October 12th, 1996, for the March on Washington.